Death of an Expert Witness, Disc 3.
Book 2. Death in a White Coat. Chapter 1. It was very peaceful in the front hall of Hoggart's at 8:40 in the morning. Brenda often thought that this was the part of the working day she liked best, the hour before the staff arrived and the work of the lab got really under way, when she and Inspector Blakelock worked together in the quiet emptiness of the hall, still and solemn as a church, making up a supply of manila folders ready to register the day's new cases, repacking exhibits for collection by the police, making a final check of the laboratory reports to courts to ensure that the examination was complete, that no relevant detail had been omitted. Immediately on arrival, she would put on her white coat, and at once she felt different. No longer young and uncertain, but a professional woman, almost like a scientist, a recognized member of the lab staff. Then she would go into the kitchen at the back of the house and make tea. After the dignification of the white coat, this domestic chore was something of a letdown, and she didn't really need a drink so soon after breakfast. But Inspector Blakelock, who motored from Ely every day, was always ready for his tea, and she didn't mind making it. "That's the stuff to give the troops," he would invariably say, curving back moist lips to the mug's brim and gulping the hot liquid down as if his throat were asbestos. "You make a nice cup of tea, Brenda. I'll say that for you." And she would reply, "Mum says the secret is always to warm the pot and let the tea brew for just 5 minutes." This small ritual exchange, so invariable that she could silently mouth his words and had to resist an impulse to giggle, the familiar domestic aroma of the tea, the gradual warmth as she curved her hands around the thick mug, constituted a reassuring and comforting beginning to the working day. She liked Inspector Blakelock. He spoke seldom, but he was never impatient with her, always kind, a companionable father figure. Even her mother, when she visited the lab before Brenda took up her post, had been happy about her working alone with him. Brenda's cheeks still burned with shame when she remembered her mother's insistence that she should visit Hoggart's to see where her daughter was going to work, although Chief Inspector Martin, the senior police liaison officer, had apparently thought it perfectly reasonable. He had explained to her mother how it was an innovation for Hoggart's to have a clerical officer on the desk instead of a junior police officer. If she made a success of the job, it would mean a permanent saving in police manpower as well as useful training for her. As Chief Inspector Martin had told her mother, the reception desk is the heart of the laboratory. At present, he was with a party of police officers visiting the United States, and Inspector Blakelock was totally in charge, doing the two jobs, not only receiving the exhibits, making out the register of court attendances and preparing the statistics, but discussing the cases with the detective in charge, explaining what the laboratory could hope to do, rejecting those cases where the scientists couldn't help, and checking that the final statements for the court were complete. Brenda guessed that it was a big responsibility for him, and was determined not to let him down. Already, when she had been making the tea, the first exhibit of the day had arrived, brought in no doubt by a detective constable working on the case. It was another plastic bag of clothes from the Clunch Pit murder. As Inspector Blakelock turned it over in his large hands, she glimpsed through the plastic a pair of dark blue trousers with a greasy waistband, a wide lapelled striped jacket, and a pair of black shoes with pointed toes and ornate buckles. Inspector Blakelock was studying the police report. He said, "These belong to the boyfriend she was messing about with at the dance. You'll need a new file for the report, but register it to biology under the Muddington reference with a subgroup number. Then attach one of the red immediate slips. Murder gets priority." "But we might have two or three murders at the same time. Who decides the priority then?" "The head of the department concerned. It's his job to allocate the work to his staff. After murder and rape, It's usual to give priority to those cases where the accused hasn't been bailed. Brenda said, I hope you don't mind my asking so many questions. Only I do want to learn. Dr. Lorimer told me that I ought to find out all I can and not just look on this job as routine. You ask away, lass. I don't mind. Only you don't want to listen too much to Dr. Lorimer. He isn't the director here, even if he thinks he is. When you've registered that clubber, the bundle goes on the biology shelf.
Brenda entered the exhibit number carefully in the daybook and moved the plastic-shrouded bundle to the shelf of exhibits waiting to go into the biology search room. It was good to be up to date with the entering. She glanced up at the clock. It was nearly 8:50. Soon the day's mail would be delivered, and the desk would be heaped with padded envelopes containing yesterday's blood samples from the drunken driving cases. Then the police cars would start arriving. Uniformed or plain-clothes policemen would bring in large envelopes of documents for Mr. Middlemas, the document examiner, specially prepared kits issued by the laboratory for the collection of saliva, blood and semen stains, unwieldy bags of stained and dirty bed linen and blankets, the ubiquitous blunt instruments, blood-stained knives carefully taped into their boxes. And at any moment now, the first members of staff would be arriving. Mrs. Bidwell, the cleaner, should have been with them 20 minutes ago. Perhaps she had caught Scobie's influenza. The first of the scientific staff to arrive would probably be Clifford Bradley, the higher scientific officer in the biology department, scurrying through the hall as if he had no right to be there, with his anxious, hunted eyes and that stupid, drooping moustache, so preoccupied that he hardly noticed their greeting. Then Miss Foley, the director's secretary, calm and self-possessed, wearing always that secret smile. Miss Foley reminded Brenda of Mona Rigby at school, who was always chosen to play the Madonna in the Christmas Nativity play. She had never liked Mona Rigby, who wouldn't have been chosen twice for the coveted role if the staff had known as much about her as did Brenda. And she wasn't sure that she really liked Miss Foley. Then someone she did like, Mr. Middlemas, the document examiner, with his jacket slung over his shoulders, leaping up the stairs 3 steps at a time and calling out a greeting to the desk. After that, they would come in almost any order. The hall would become alive with people, rather like a railway terminus, and at the heart of the seeming chaos, controlling and directing, helping and explaining, were the staff of the reception desk. As if to signal that the working day was about to begin, the telephone rang. Inspector Blakelock's hand enveloped the receiver. He listened in silence for what seemed a longer period than normal. Then she heard him speak. I don't think he's here, Mr. Lorimer. You say he never came home last night? Another silence. Inspector Blakelock half turned away from her and bent his head conspiratorially over the mouthpiece, as if listening to a confidence. Then he rested the receiver on the counter and turned to Brenda. It's Dr. Lorimer's old dad. He's worried. Apparently Dr. Lorimer didn't take him his early tea this morning, and it looks as if he didn't come home last night. His bed hasn't been slept in. Well, he can't be here. I mean, we found the front door locked when we arrived. There could be no doubt about that. As she had come round the corner of the house from putting her bicycle in the old stable block, Inspector Blakelock had been standing at the front door, almost as if he were waiting for her. Then, when she had joined him, he had shone his flashlight onto the locks and inserted the 3 keys, first the Yale and then the Ingersoll, and lastly the security lock, which disconnected the electronic warning system from Guy's Marsh police station. Then they had stepped together into the unlighted hall. She had gone to the cloakroom at the back of the building to put on her white coat, and he had gone to the box in Chief Inspector Martin's office to switch off the system that protected the inner doors of the main laboratory rooms. She giggled and said, Mrs. Bidwell hasn't turned up to start the cleaning, and now Dr. Lorimer's missing. Perhaps they've run away together. The great Argot scandal. It wasn't a very funny joke, and she wasn't surprised when Inspector Blakelock didn't laugh.
he said. The locked door doesn't necessarily signify. Dr. Lorimer has his own keys. And if he did make his bed and then come in extra early this morning, like as not, he'd have relocked the door and set the internal alarms. But how could he have got into the biology lab then? He'd have had to have opened the door and then left it open when he reset the alarms. Well, it doesn't seem likely. When he's here alone, he usually relies on the Yale. He put the receiver again to his ear and said, "Hold on a moment, will you, Mr. Lorimer? I don't think he's here, but I'll just check." "I'll go," said Brenda, anxious to demonstrate helpfulness. Without waiting to lift the hatch, she slipped under the counter. As she turned, she saw him with startling clarity, brightly instantaneous as a camera flash. Inspector Blakelock, with his mouth half open in remonstrance, his arm flung out towards her in a gesture stiff and histrionic of protection or restraint. But now, uncomprehending, she laughed and ran up the wide stairs. The biology laboratory was at the back of the second floor, running, with its adjoining search room, almost the whole length of the building. The door was shut. She turned the knob and pushed it open, feeling along the wall for the light switch. Her fingers found it, and she pressed it down. The two long fluorescent tubes suspended from the ceiling blinked, then glimmered, then glowed into steady light. She saw the body immediately. He was lying in the space between the two large central examination tables, face downward, his left hand seeming to claw at the floor, his right arm hunched beneath him. His legs were straight. She gave a curious little sound between a cry and a moan and knelt beside him. The hair above his left ear was matted and spiked, like her kitten's fur after he had washed. And she couldn't see the blood against the dark hair, but she knew that it was blood. Already it had blackened on the collar of his white coat, and a small pool had separated and congealed on the lab floor. Only his left eye was visible, fixed and dull and retracted, like the eye of a dead calf. Tentatively, she felt his cheek. It was cold. But she had known, as soon as she had seen that glazed eye, that this was death. She had no memory of closing the lab door or coming down the stairs. Inspector Blakelock was still behind the counter, rigid as a statue, the telephone receiver in his hand. She wanted to laugh at the sight of his face. He looked so funny. She tried to speak to him, but the words wouldn't come. Her jaw jabbered uncontrollably, and her teeth clattered together. She made some kind of gesture. He said something that she couldn't catch, dropped the receiver on the counter, and raced upstairs. She staggered to the heavy Victorian armchair against the wall outside Chief Inspector Martin's office, Colonel Hoggart's chair. The portrait looked down at her. As she watched, the left eye seemed to grow larger, the lips twisted to a leer. Her whole body was seized with a terrible cold. Her heart seemed to have grown immense, thudding against the rib cage. She was breathing in great gulps, but still there wasn't enough air. Then she became aware of the crackling from the telephone. Rising slowly like an automaton, she made her way over to the counter and picked up the receiver. Mr. Lorimer's voice, frail and querulous, was bleating at the other end. She tried to say the accustomed words, "Hoggart's laboratory here, reception speaking," but the words wouldn't come. She replaced the receiver in its cradle and walked back to her chair. She had no memory of hearing the long peal of the doorbell, of moving stiffly across the hall to answer it. Suddenly the door crashed open, and the hall was full of people, loud with voices. The light seemed to have brightened, which was odd, and she saw them all like actors on a stage, brightly lit, faces made grotesque and heightened by makeup, every word clear and comprehensible, as if she were in the front row of the stalls. Mrs. Bidwell, the cleaner, in her mackintosh with the imitation fur collar, her eyes bright with indignation, her voice pitched high. "What the hell's going on here? Some bloody fool phoned my old man and told him that I needn't come in today, that Mrs. Schofield wanted me. Who's playing silly buggers?"
Inspector Blakelock was coming down the stairs, slowly and deliberately, the chief protagonist making his entrance. They stood in a small circle and looked up at him. Dr. Howarth, Clifford Bradley, Miss Foley, Mrs. Bidwell. The director stepped forward. He looked as if he were going to faint. He said, "Well, Blakelock?"
"It's Dr. Lorimer, sir. He's dead. Murdered."
Surely they couldn't all have repeated that word in unison, turning their faces toward each other like a Greek chorus. But it seemed to echo in the quiet of the hall, becoming meaningless, a sonorous groan of a word, "Murder, murder, murder." She saw Dr. Howarth run toward the stairs. Inspector Blakelock turned to accompany him, but the director said, "No, you stay here. See that no one gets any further than the hall. Phone the Chief Constable and Dr. Kerrison. Then get me the Home Office." Suddenly they seemed to notice Brenda for the first time. Mrs. Bidwell came toward her. She said, "Did you find him then? You poor little bugger." And suddenly it wasn't a play any more. The lights went out. The faces became amorphous, ordinary. Brenda gave a little gasp. She felt Mrs. Bidwell's arms go round her shoulders. The smell of the Macintosh was pressed into her face. The fur was as soft as her kitten's paw. And blessedly, Brenda began to cry. Chapter 2. In a London teaching hospital close by the river, from which he could, in his more masochistic moments, glimpse the window of his own office, Dr. Charles Freeborn, controller of the Forensic Science Service, all 6'4" of him, lay rigidly in his narrow bed, his nose peaked high above the methodical fold of the sheet, his white hair a haze against the whiter pillow. The bed was too short for him, an inconvenience to which he had accommodated himself by neatly sticking out his toes over the footboard. His bedside locker held the conglomerate of offerings, necessities, and minor diversions considered indispensable to a brief spell in the hospital. They included a vase of official-looking roses, scentless but florid, and through whose funereal and unnatural blooms Commander Adam Dalgleish glimpsed a face so immobile, upturned eyes fixed on the ceiling, that he was momentarily startled by the illusion that he was visiting the dead. Recalling that Freeborn was recovering from nothing more serious than a successful operation for varicose veins, he approached the bed and said tentatively, "Hello?" Freeborn, galvanized from his torpor, sprang up like a jack-in-the-box, scattering from his bedside locker a packet of tissues, 2 copies of the Journal of the Forensic Science Society, and an open box of chocolates. He shot out a lean, speckled arm encircled by the hospital identity bracelet and crushed Dalgleish's hand. "Adam, don't creep up on me like that, damn you! God, am I glad to see you! The only good news I've had this morning is that you'll be in charge. I thought that you might have already left. How long can you spare? How are you getting there?"
Dalgleish answered the questions in order. 10 minutes. By chopper from the Battersea heliport. I'm on my way now.
How are you, Charles? Am I being a nuisance?" "I'm the nuisance. This couldn't have happened at a worse time. And the maddening part of it is that it's my own fault. The op could have waited. Only the pain was getting rather tedious, and Meg insisted that I have it done now before I retire. On the theory, I suppose, that better in the government's time than my own."
Recalling what he knew of the ardours and achievements of Freeborn's 40-odd years in the Forensic Science Service, the difficult war years, the delayed retirement, the last 5 years when he had exchanged his directorship for the frustrations of bureaucracy, Dalgleish said, "Sensible of her, and there's nothing you could have done at Chevisham."
"I know. It's ridiculous. this feeling of responsibility, because one isn't actually at one's post when disaster strikes. They phoned from the duty office to break the news to me, just after 9. Better that than learning it from my visitors or this evening's paper, I suppose, they thought. Decent of them. The chief constable must have called in the yard within a few minutes of getting the news. How much do you know?
About as much as you, I imagine. I've spoken to the CC and to Howarth. They've given me the main facts. The skull smashed, apparently by a heavy mallet, which Lorimer had been examining. The lab found properly locked when the assistant police liaison officer and the young CO arrived at 8:30 this morning. Lorimer's keys in his pocket. He often worked late, and most of the lab staff knew that he proposed to do so last night. No sign of a break-in. 4 sets of keys. Lorimer had 1 set as the senior PSO and deputy security officer. The assistant police liaison officer has the 2nd. Lorimer, or one of the police liaison officers, were the only people authorised to lock and open up the building. The director keeps the 3rd set of keys in his security cupboard, and the 4th is in a safe at Guy's Marsh police station in case the alarm rings in the night. Freeborn said, "So, either Lorimer let in his murderer, or the murderer had a key." There were, thought Dalgleish, other possibilities, but now was not the time to discuss them. He asked, "Lorimer would have let anyone in from the lab, I suppose." "Why not? He'd probably have admitted any of the local police whom he personally knew, particularly if it were a detective concerned with a recent case. Otherwise, I'm not so sure. He may have admitted a friend or relative, although that's even more doubtful. He was a punctilious blighter. I can't see him using the lab as a convenient place for a rendezvous. And, of course, he would have let in the forensic pathologist." "That's a local man, Henry Kerrison, they tell me. The CC said that they called him in to look at the body. Well, they could hardly do anything else. I didn't know you'd found a successor to Death House Donald." "Nor have we. Kerrison is doing it on an item-of-service basis. He's well thought of, and we'll probably appoint him if we can get the Area Health Authority to agree. There's the usual difficulty about his hospital responsibilities. I wish to hell we could get the forensic pathology service sorted out before I go. But that's one headache I'll have to leave to my successor." Dalgleish thought, without affection, of Death House Donald, with his ghoulish schoolboy humour. "Not that cake knife, my dear lady. I used it this morning on one of Slash Harry's victims, and the edge is rather blunted." His mania for self-advertisement, and his intolerable bucolic laugh, and was grateful that at least he wouldn't be interrogating that redoubtable old phony. He said, "Tell me about Lorimer. What was he like?" This was the question that lay at the heart of every murder investigation, and yet he knew its absurdity before he asked it. It was the strangest part of a detective's job, this building up of a relationship with the dead, seen only as a crumpled corpse at the scene of crime or naked on the mortuary table. The victim was central to the mystery of his own death. He died because of what he was. Before the case was finished, Dalgleish would have received 12 pictures of Lorimer's personality, transferred like prints from other men's minds. From these amorphous and uncertain images, he would create his own imaginings, superimposed and dominant, but essentially just as incomplete, just as distorted, as were the others, by his own preconceptions, his own personality. But the question had to be asked, and at least he could rely on Freeborn to answer it without initiating a philosophical discussion about the basis of the self. But their minds must for a moment have flowed together, for Freeborn said, "It's odd how you always have to ask that question. Aged about 40. Looks like John the Baptist without his beard, and is about as uncompromising. Single. Lives with an elderly father in a cottage just outside the village. He is, was, an extremely competent forensic biologist, but I doubt whether he would have gone any higher. Obsessional, edgy, uncomfortable to be with. He applied for the job at Hoggart's, of course, and was runner-up to Howarth.
How did he and the lab take the new appointment?
Lorimer took it pretty hard, I believe. The lab wouldn't have welcomed his appointment. He was pretty unpopular with most of the senior staff. But there are always one or two who would have preferred a colleague to a stranger, even if they hated his guts. And the union made the expected noises about not appointing a forensic scientist.
Why did you appoint Howarth? I take it you were on the board.
Oh, yes. I accept a share of the responsibility. That's not to say that I think we made a mistake. Old Dr. Mack was one of the really great forensic scientists. We started together. But there's no denying that he'd let the reins slip a bit in recent years. Howarth has already increased the work turnover by 10%. And then there's the commissioning of the new lab. It was a calculated risk to take a man without forensic experience, but we were looking for a manager, primarily. At least, most of the board were, and the rest of us were persuaded that it would be no bad thing, without, I confess, being precisely clear what we meant by that blessed word, management. The new science. We all make obeisance to it. In the old days, we got on with the job, jollied staff along if they needed it, kicked the sluggers in the backside, encouraged the unconfident, and persuaded a reluctant and sceptical police force to use us. Oh, and sent in an occasional statistical return to the Home Office, just to remind them that we were there. It seemed to work all right. Service didn't collapse. Have you ever considered what exactly is the difference between administration and management, Adam?
Keep it as a question to confound the candidate at your next board. Howarth was at the Bruce Research Institute, wasn't he? Why did he want to leave? He must have taken a cut in pay.
Not more than about 600 a year. That wouldn't worry him. His father was rich, and it all came to him and his half-sister.
But it's a bigger place, surely. And he can't be getting the research at Hoggart's.
He gets some. But essentially, of course, it's a service laboratory. That worried us a bit on the board. But you can hardly set out to persuade your most promising applicant that he's downgrading himself. Scientifically and academically, he's a pure physicist. He was well ahead of the rest of the field. Actually, we did press him a bit, and he gave the usual reasons. He was getting stale, wanted a new sphere of activity, was anxious to get away from London. Gossip has it that his wife had recently left him and he wanted to make a clean break. That was probably the reason. Well, thank God he didn't use that blasted word challenge. If I have to listen to one more candidate telling me he sees the job as a challenge, I'll throw up over the boardroom table. Adam, I'm getting old.
He nodded his head toward the window.
They're in a bit of a twitch over there, I need hardly say.
I know. I've had an exceedingly brief but tactful interview. They're brilliant at implying more than they actually say. But obviously it's important to get it solved quickly. Apart from confidence in the service, you'll all want to get the lab back to work.
What's happening now? To the staff, I mean.
The local CID have locked all the interior doors, and they're keeping the staff in the library and the reception area until I arrive. They're occupying themselves writing out an account of their movements since Lorimer was last seen alive, and the local force are getting on with the preliminary checking of alibis. That should save some time. I'm taking one officer, John Massingham, with me. The Met Lab will take on any of the forensic work. They're sending a chap down from Public Relations Branch to handle the publicity, so I won't have that on my plate. It's obliging of that pop group to break up so spectacularly. That and the government's troubles should keep us off the front page for a day or two.
Freeborn was looking down at his big toes with mild distaste, as if they were errant members whose deficiencies had only now become apparent to him. From time to time he wriggled them. Whether in obedience to some medical instruction or for his own private satisfaction, it was impossible to say. After a moment, he spoke.
I started my career at Hoggart's, you know. That was before the war. All any of us had then was wet chemistry, test tubes, beakers, solutions.
and girls weren't employed, because it wasn't decent for them to be concerned with sex cases. Hoggart's was old-fashioned, even for the 1930 service. Not scientifically, though. We had a spectrograph when it was still the new wonder toy. The Fens threw up some odd crimes. Do you remember the Mulligan case? Old man who chopped up his brother, tied the remains to the leaming sluice gates. There was some nice forensic evidence there.
Some 50 bloodstains on the pigsty wall, weren't there? And Mulligan swore it was sow's blood.
Freeborn's voice grew reminiscent.
I like that old villain. And they still drag out those photographs I took of the splashes and use them to illustrate lectures on bloodstains.
Odd, the attraction Hoggart's had, still has, for that matter. An unsuitable Palladian mansion in an unexciting East Anglian village on the edge of the Black Fens, 10 miles to Ely, and that's hardly a centre of riotous activity for the young. Winter's to freeze your marrow, a spring wind, the Fen blow, they call it, that whips up the peat and chokes your lungs like smog. And yet the staff, if they didn't leave after the first month, stayed for ever. Did you know that Hoggart's has got a small wren chapel on the lab grounds? Architecturally, it's much superior to the house, because old Hoggart never messed with it. He was almost entirely without aesthetic taste, I believe.
He used it as a chemical store once it had been deconsecrated, or whatever it is they do to unused churches.
Howarth has got a string quartet going at the lab, and they gave a concert there. Apparently he's a noted amateur violinist. At the moment he's probably wishing that he'd stuck to music. This isn't a propitious start for him, poor devil. And it was always such a happy lab. I suppose it was the isolation that gave us such a feeling of camaraderie.
Dalgleish said grimly, I doubt whether that will survive an hour of my arrival.
No. You chaps usually bring as much trouble with you as you solve. You can't help it. Murder is like that. A contaminating crime. Oh, you'll solve it, I know. You always do. But I'm wondering, at what cost?
Dalgleish did not answer. He was both too honest and too fond of Freeborn to make comforting and platitudinous promises. Of course he would be tactful. That didn't need saying. But he would be at Hoggart's to solve a murder, and all other considerations would go down before that overriding task. Murder was always solved at a cost, sometimes to himself, more often to others. And Freeborn was right. It was a crime that contaminated everyone whom it touched, innocent and guilty alike. He didn't grudge the 10 minutes he had spent with Freeborn. The old man believed, with simple patriotism, that the service to which he had given the whole of his working life was the best in the world. He had helped to shape it, and he was probably right. Dalgleish had learned what he had come to learn. But as he shook hands and said goodbye, he knew that he left no comfort behind him.
Chapter 3. The library at Hoggart's was at the rear of the ground floor. Its 3 tall windows gave a view of the stone terrace and the double flight of steps going down to what had once been a lawn and formal gardens, but which was now a half acre of neglected grass, bounded to the west by the brick annex of the vehicle examination department, and to the east by the old stable block, now converted into garages. The room was one of the few in the house spared by its former owner's transforming zeal. The original bookcases of carved oak still lined the walls, although they now housed the laboratory's not inconsiderable scientific library, while extra shelf room for bound copies of national and international journals had been provided by 2 movable steel units, which divided the room into 3 bays. Under each of the 3 windows was a working table with 4 chairs. One table was almost completely covered by a model of the new laboratory. It was in this somewhat inadequate space that the staff were congregated.
A detective sergeant from the local CID sat impassively near the door, a reminder of why they were so inconveniently incarcerated. They were allowed out to the ground floor cloakroom under tactful escort, and had been told they could telephone home from the library. But the rest of the laboratory was at present out of bounds.
They had all, on arrival, been asked to write a brief account of where they had been and with whom the previous evening and night. Patiently they waited their turn at one of the three tables. The statements had been collected by the sergeant and handed out to his colleague on the reception desk, presumably so that the preliminary checking could begin. Those of the junior staff who could provide a satisfactory alibi were allowed home as soon as it had been checked, one by one, and with some reluctance at missing the excitements to come, they went their way. The less fortunate, together with those who had arrived first at the laboratory that morning, and all the senior scientists, had been told that they must await the arrival of the team from Scotland Yard. The director had put in only one brief appearance at the library. Earlier, he had gone with Angela Foley to break the news of Lorimer's death to his father. Since his return, he had stayed in his own office with Detective Superintendent Mercer of the local CID. It was rumoured that Dr. Kerrison was with them.
The minutes dragged while they listened for the first hum of the approaching helicopter. Inhibited by the presence of the police, by prudence, delicacy, or embarrassment from talking about the subject foremost in their minds, they spoke to each other with the wary politeness of uncongenial strangers stranded in an airport lounge. The women were, on the whole, better equipped for the tedium of the wait. Mrs. Mallett, the typist from the general office, had brought her knitting to work, and, fortified by an unshakable alibi, she had sat between the postmistress and Mr. Mason from the general store at the village concert, and with something to occupy her hands, sat clicking away with understandable, if irritating, complacency until given the order of release. Mrs. Bidwell, the laboratory cleaner, had insisted on visiting her broom cupboard under escort, and had provided herself with a feather duster and a couple of rags, with which she made a vigorous onslaught on the bookshelves. She was unusually silent, but the group of scientists at the tables could hear her muttering to herself as she punished the books at the end of one of the bays. Brenda Pridmore had been allowed to collect the exhibits received book from the counter, and, white-faced but outwardly composed, was checking the previous month's figures. The book took more than its share of the available table space, but at least she had a legitimate job. Claire Easterbrook, senior scientific officer in the biology department, and, with Lorimer's death, the senior biologist, had taken from her briefcase a scientific paper she had prepared on recent advances in blood grouping, and had settled down to revise it with as little apparent concern as if murder at Hoggart's were a routine inconvenience, for which, prudently, she was always provided. The rest of the staff passed the time each in his own way. Those who preferred the pretense of business immersed themselves in a book and from time to time made an ostentatious note. The two vehicle examiners, who were reputed to have no conversation except about cars, squatted side by side, their backs against the steel book racks, and talked cars together with desperate eagerness. Middlemas had finished the Times crossword by 9:45 and had made the rest of the paper last as long as possible. But now even the deaths column was exhausted. He folded the paper and tossed it across the table to eagerly waiting hands. It was a relief when Stephen Copley, the senior chemist, arrived just before 10, bustling in as usual, his rubicund face with its tonsure and fringe of black curly hair, glistening as if he had come in from the sun. Nothing was known to disconcert him, certainly not the death of a man he had disliked. But he was secure in his alibi, having spent the whole of the previous day in the Crown Court, and the evening and night with friends at Norwich, only getting back to Chevisham in time for a late start that morning. His colleagues, relieved to find something to talk about, began questioning him about the case. They spoke rather too loudly to be natural. The rest of the company listened with simulated interest, as if the conversation were a dramatic dialogue provided for their entertainment.
"Who did they call for the defence?" asked Middlemas.
"Charlie Pollard." He hung his great belly over the box and explained confidentially to the jury that they needn't be frightened of the so-called scientific expert witnesses, because none of us, including himself, of course, really know what we're talking about. They were immensely reassured, I need hardly say.
"Juries hate scientific evidence."
"They think they won't be able to understand it, so naturally they can't understand it. As soon as you step into the box, you see a curtain of obstinate incomprehension clanging down over their minds. What they want is certainty. Did this paint particle come from this car body? Answer yes or no. None of those nasty mathematical probabilities we're so fond of."
"If they hate scientific evidence, they certainly hate arithmetic more. Give them a scientific opinion that depends on the ability to divide a factor by two-thirds, and what do you get from counsel?"
"I'm afraid you'll have to explain yourself more simply, Mr. Middlemas. The jury and I haven't got a higher degree in mathematics, you know."
"Inference, you're an arrogant bastard, and the jury would be well advised not to believe a word you say." It was the old argument. Brenda had heard it all before, when she ate her lunchtime sandwiches in the room, halfway between a kitchen and a sitting room, which was still called the junior mess. But now it seemed terrible that they should be able to talk so naturally, while Dr. Lorimer lay there dead upstairs. Suddenly she had a need to speak his name. She looked up and made herself say, "Dr. Lorimer thought that the service would end up with about three immense laboratories doing the work for the whole country with exhibits coming in by air. He said that he thought all the scientific evidence ought to be agreed by both sides before the trial."
Middlemas said easily, "That's an old argument. The police want a local lab nice and handy, and who's to blame them? Besides, three-quarters of forensic scientific work doesn't require all this sophisticated instrumentation. There's more of a case for highly equipped regional laboratories with local outstations. But who'd want to work in the small labs if the more exciting stuff went elsewhere?"
Miss Easterbrook had apparently finished her revision. She said,
"Lorimer knew that this idea of the lab as a scientific arbiter wouldn't work, not with the British accusatorial system. Anyway, scientific evidence ought to be tested like any other evidence."
"But how?" asked Middlemas. "By an ordinary jury?
Suppose you're an expert document examiner outside the service, and they call you for the defence. You and I disagree. How can the jury judge between us? They'll probably choose to believe you, because you're better looking.
Or you, more likely, because you're a man. Or one of them, the crucial one, will reject me because I remind him of Uncle Ben, and all the family know that Ben was the world's champion liar."
"All right, all right."
Copley spread plump hands in a benediction of appeasement.
"It's the same as democracy. A fallible system, but the best we've got."
Middlemas said, "It's extraordinary, though, how well it works. You look at the jury, sitting there politely attentive, like children on their best behaviour because they're visitors in an alien country and don't want to make fools of themselves or offend the natives. Yet how often do they come up with a verdict that's manifestly perverse, having regard to the evidence?"
Claire Easterbrook said dryly, "Whether it's manifestly perverse having regard to the truth is another matter. A criminal trial isn't a tribunal for eliciting the truth. At least we deal in facts. What about the emotions? Did you love your husband, Mrs. B? How can the poor woman explain that probably, like the majority of wives, she loved him most of the time, when he didn't snore in her ear all night, or shout at the kids, or keep her short of bingo money?"
Copley said, "She can't. If she's got any sense, and if her counsellor's briefed her properly, she'll get out her handkerchief and sob, 'Oh, yes, sir, a better husband never lived, as God's my witness.' It's a game, isn't it? You win if you play by the rules."
Claire Easterbrook shrugged.
"If you know them. Too often it's a game where the rules are known only to one side. Natural enough,
when that's the side that makes them up. Copley and Middlemas laughed. Clifford Bradley had half hidden himself from the rest of the company behind the table holding the model of the new laboratory. He had taken a book from the shelves at random, but for the last 10 minutes hadn't even bothered to turn the page.
They were laughing. They were actually laughing.
Getting up from the table, he groped his way down the farthest bay and replaced his book in the rack, leaning his forehead against the cold steel. Unobtrusively, Middlemas strolled up beside him and, back to the company, reached up to take a book from the shelf. He said, "Are you all right?"
"I wish to God they'd come."
"So do we all, but the chopper should be here any minute now."
"How can they laugh like that? Don't they care?"
"Of course they care. Murder is beastly, embarrassing and inconvenient. But I doubt whether anyone is feeling a purely personal grief. And other people's tragedies, other people's danger, always provoke a certain euphoria, as long as one is safe oneself." He looked at Bradley and said softly, "There's always manslaughter, you know, or even justified homicide. Though, come to think of it, one could hardly plead that."
"You think I killed him, don't you?"
"I don't think anything. Anyway, you've got an alibi. Wasn't your mother-in-law with you yesterday evening?"
"Not all evening. She caught the 7:45 bus."
"Well, with luck, there'll be evidence that he was dead by then." And why, thought Middlemas, should Bradley assume that he wasn't? Bradley's dark and anxious eyes narrowed with suspicion.
"How did you know that Sue's mother was with us last night?"
"Susan told me. Actually, she telephoned me at the lab just before 2. It was about Lorimer." He thought, and then said easily, "She was wondering whether there was a chance he might ask for a transfer, now that Howarth has been in the post a year. She thought I might have heard something. When you get home, tell her that I don't propose to tell the police about the call unless she does first. Oh, and you'd better reassure her that I didn't bash in his head for him. I do a lot for Sue, but a man has to draw the line somewhere." Bradley said with a note of resentment, "Why should you worry? There's nothing wrong with your alibi. Weren't you at the village concert?"
"Not all the evening. And there's a certain slight embarrassment about my alibi, even when I was ostensibly there."
Bradley turned to him and said with sudden vehemence,
"I didn't do it! Oh, God, I can't stand this waiting!"
"You've got to stand it. Pull yourself together, Cliff. You won't help yourself or Susan by going to pieces. They're English policemen, remember? We're not expecting the KGB. It was then that they heard the long-awaited sound, a distant grinding hum like that of an angry wasp. The desultory voices at the tables fell silent. Heads were raised, and together the company moved toward the windows. Mrs. Bidwell rushed for a place of vantage. The red and white helicopter rattled into sight over the top of the trees and hovered, a noisy gadfly, above the terrace. No one spoke. Then Middlemas said, "The Yard's Wonder Boy appropriately descends from the clouds. Well, let's hope that he works quickly. I want to get into my lab. Someone should tell him that he's not the only one with murder on his hands." Chapter 4. Detective Inspector the Honourable John Massingham disliked helicopters, which he regarded as noisy, cramped, and frighteningly unsafe. Since his physical courage was beyond question by either himself or anyone else, he would normally have had no objection to saying so. But he knew his chief's dislike of unnecessary chat, and strapped as they were side by side in uncomfortably close proximity in the Enstrom F-28, he decided that the Chevisham case would get off to the most propitious start by a policy of disciplined silence. He noted with interest that the cockpit instrument panel was remarkably similar to a car dashboard.
Even the airspeed was shown in miles per hour instead of knots. He was only sorry that there the resemblance ended. He adjusted his earphones more comfortably and settled down to soothe his nerves by a concentrated study of his maps. The red-brown tentacles of London's suburbs had at last been shaken off, and the checkered autumn landscape, multi-textured as a cloth collage, unrolled before them into a changing pattern of brown, green and gold, leading them on to Cambridge. The fitful sunshine moved in broad swathes across the neat segmented villages, the trim municipal parks and open fields. Miniature tin cars, beetle bright in the sun, pursued each other busily along the roads. Dalgliesh glanced at his companion, at the strong, pale face, the spatter of freckles over the craggy nose and wide forehead, and the thatch of red hair springing under the headphones, and thought how like the boy was to his father, that redoubtable, thrice-decorated peer, whose courage was equalled only by his obstinacy and naivety. The marvel of the Massinghams was that a lineage going back 500 years could have produced so many generations of amiable nonentities. He remembered when he had last seen Lord Dungannon. It had been a debate in the House of Lords on juvenile delinquency, a subject on which he considered himself an expert, since he had, indubitably, once been a boy, and had, briefly, helped organise a youth club on his grandfather's estate. His thoughts, when they finally came, had been uttered in all their simplistic banality, in no particular order of logic or relevance, and in a curiously gentle voice, punctuated by long pauses, in which he had gazed thoughtfully at the throne and appeared to commune happily with some inner presence. Meanwhile, like lemmings who have smelled the sea, the noble lords streamed out of their chamber in a body, to appear as if summoned by telepathy when Dungannon's speech drew to its close. But if the family had contributed nothing to statesmanship and little to the arts, they had died with spectacular gallantry for orthodox causes in every generation. And now Dungannon's heir had chosen this far from orthodox job. It would be interesting to see if, for the first time, and in so unusual a field, the family achieved distinction. What had led Massingham to choose the police service, instead of his family's usual career of the army, as an outlet for his natural combativeness and unfashionable patriotism, Dalgliesh had not inquired, partly because he was a respecter of other men's privacy, and partly because he wasn't sure that he wanted to hear the answer. So far, Massingham had done exceptionally well. The police were a tolerant body, and took the view that a man couldn't help who his father was. They accepted that Massingham had gained his promotion on merit, although they were not so naive as to suppose that being the elder son of a peer did any man harm. They called Massingham On John, behind his back, and occasionally to his face, and bore no malice. Although the family was now impoverished and the estate sold, Lord Dungannon was bringing up his considerable family in a modest villa in Bayswater, the boy had still gone to his father's school. No doubt, thought Dalgliesh, the old warrior was unaware that other schools existed. Like every other class, the aristocracy, however poor, could always find the money for the things they really wanted. But he was an odd product of that establishment, having none of the slightly dégagé elegance and ironic detachment which characterised its alumni. Dalgliesh, if he hadn't known its history, would have guessed that Massingham was the product of a sound, upper-middle-class family, a doctor or a solicitor, perhaps, and of an old established grammar school. It was only the second time they had worked together. The first time, Dalgliesh had been impressed by Massingham's intelligence and enormous capacity for work, and by his admirable ability to keep his mouth shut, and to sense when his chief wanted to be alone. He had also been struck by a streak of ruthlessness in the boy, which he thought ought not to have surprised him, since he knew that, as with all good detectives, it must be present. And now the Enstrom was rattling above the towers and spires of Cambridge, and they could see the shining curve of the river, the bright autumnal avenues leading down through green lawns to miniature hump-backed bridges, King's College Chapel upturned and slowly rotating beside its great striped square of green. And, almost immediately, the city was behind them, and they saw, like a crinkled ebony sea, the black earth of the fens. Below them were straight roads, ridged above the fields, with villages strung along them as if clinging to the security of high ground. Isolated farms, with their roofs so low that they looked half submerged in the peat. An occasional church tower standing majestically apart from its village, with the gravestones planted around it like crooked teeth. They must be getting close now. Already Dalgliesh could see the soaring west tower and pinnacles of Ely Cathedral to the east. Massingham looked up from his map reading and peered down. His voice crackled through Dalgliesh's earphones. "This is it, sir." Chevisham was spread beneath them. It lay on a narrow plateau above the fens, the houses strung along the northerly of two converging roads. The tower of the impressive cruciform church was immediately identifiable, as were Jeversham Manor, and behind it, sprawling over the scarred field and linking the two roads, the brick and concrete of the new laboratory building. They rattled along the main street of what looked like a typical East Anglian village. Dalgliesh glimpsed the ornate red brick front of the local chapel, one or two prosperous-looking houses with Dutch gables, a small close of recently built semi-detached boxes with the developer's board still in place, and what looked like the village general store and post office. There were few people about, but the noise of the engines brought figures from shops and houses, and pale faces, their eyes shielded, strained up at them. And now they were turning towards Hoggart's Laboratory, coming in low over what must be the Wren Chapel. It stood about a quarter of a mile from the house, in a triple circle of beech trees, an isolated building so small and perfect that it looked like an architect's model precisely set in a fabricated landscape, or an elegant ecclesiastical folly, justifying itself only by its classical purity, as distanced from religion as it was from life. It was odd that it lay so far from the house. Dalgliesh thought it had probably been built later, perhaps because the original owner of the mansion had quarrelled with the local parson, and, in defiance, had decided to make his own arrangements for spiritual ministrations. Certainly the house hardly looked large enough to support a private chapel. For a few seconds as they descended, he had an unimpeded view, through a gap in the trees, of the west front of the chapel. He saw a single high-arched window with two balancing niches, the four Corinthian pilasters separating the bays, the whole crowned with a large decorated pediment and topped with a hexagonal lantern. The helicopter seemed almost to be brushing the trees. The brittle autumn leaves, shaken by the rush of air, flurried down like a shower of charred paper over the roof and the bright green of the grass. And then, sickeningly, the helicopter soared. The chapel lurched out of sight, and they were poised, engines rattling, ready to land on the wide terrace behind the house. Over its roof he could see the forecourt patterned with parking lots, the police cars tidily aligned, and what looked like a mortuary van. A broad drive, bordered with straggling bushes and a few trees, led down to what the map showed as Stony Piggott Road. There was no gate to the driveway. Beyond it, he could see the bright flag of a bus stop and the bus shelter. Then the helicopter began to descend, and only the rear of the house was in view. From a ground-floor window, he could see the smudges of watching faces. There was a reception committee of three, their figures oddly foreshortened, their necks straining upward. The thrash of the rotor blades had tugged their hair into grotesque shapes, flurried the legs of their trousers, and flattened their jackets against their chests. Now, with the stilling of the engines, the sudden silence was so absolute that he saw the three motionless figures as if they were a tableau of dummies in a silent world. He and Massingham unclasped their seat belts and clambered to earth. For about 5 seconds, the two groups stood regarding each other. Then, with a single gesture, the three waiting figures smoothed back their hair and advanced warily to meet him. Simultaneously, his ears unblocked, and the world again became audible. He turned to thank and speak briefly to the pilot. Then he and Massingham walked forward. Dalgleish already knew Superintendent Mercer of the local CID. They had met at a number of police conferences. Even at 60 feet, his ox-like shoulders, the round comedian's face with the wide upturned mouth and the button-bright eyes had been instantly recognizable. Dalgleish felt his hand crushed, and then Mercer made the introductions. Dr. Howarth, a tall, fair man, almost as tall as Dalgleish himself, with widely spaced eyes of a remarkably deep blue, and the lashes so long that they might have looked effeminate on any face less arrogantly male. He could, Dalgleish thought, have been judged an outstandingly handsome man, were it not for a certain incongruity of feature, perhaps the contrast between the fineness of the skin stretched over the flat cheekbones and the strong, jutting jaw and uncompromising mouth. Dalgleish would have known that he was rich. The blue eyes regarded the world with the slightly cynical assurance of a man accustomed to getting what he wanted when he wanted it, by the simplest of expedients, that of paying for it. Beside him, Dr. Henry Kerrison, though as tall, looked diminished. His creased, anxious face was bleached with weariness, and there was a look in the dark, heavily lidded eyes that was uncomfortably close to defeat. He grasped Dalgleish's hand with a firm, cool grip, but didn't speak. Howarth said, "There's no entrance now to the back of the house. We have to go round to the front. This is the easiest way." Carrying their scene of crime cases, Dalgleish and Massingham followed him around the side of the house. The faces at the ground floor window had disappeared, and it was extraordinarily quiet. Trudging through the leaves that had drifted over the path, sniffing the keen autumnal air with its hint of smokiness, and feeling the sun on his face, Massingham felt a surge of animal well-being. It was good to be out of London. This promised to be the kind of job he most liked. The little group turned the corner of the house, and Dalgleish and Massingham had their first clear view of the facade of Hoggart's laboratory.
This ends Disc 3.